Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
We know there are a lot of ways to observe the holiday season, but at GunBroker.com, we're celebrating by giving away 25 days of guns. Just visit GunBroker and check out our sweepstakes page. You can enter once every day starting December 1st, and each day you enter gives you a chance to win a new gun unveiled that day. Plus, the earlier you start entering, the more chances you get. Up to 25 entries for the first gun on December 1st, 24 for the next on December 2nd, and so on, all the way up to our big Christmas Day finale. With each entry, you're not just counting down the days, you're upping your odds of winning. So don't miss out. Fill your holiday with excitement and maybe even a new addition to your gun safe. Just head over to GunBroker.com and enter today. And happy holidays and the best of luck from all of us at GunBroker.com.
Hi, Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. I'm your host, Logan Medish of High Caliber History. As always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Alan Forgner from Gunbroker. And our guest today, we've got a repeat offender with us. We're welcoming back Adam Kraut, the executive director of the Second Amendment Foundation. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, guys. Can't believe you made this mistake twice.
Well, oh, we make a lot of mistakes many times. So
yes, lots and lots of mistakes. We're really, really bad learners, and as you can see from my hat, we can't spell for shit either. So
but I have the same problem.
But that is kind of partially why we're having you back. We are in a post-election landscape here. And we figured there was no one better to have on than you and the Second Amendment Foundation to talk us through what we might expect, what might be a little too lofty, go over some historic precedent and stuff. Because, you know, Second Amendment Foundation is not a new kid on the block. You know, you guys are celebrating your 50th anniversary. So I'd like to think you guys might know a little bit about what you're doing here.
Well, some of us do. There's others of us that sometimes run around with our heads cut off. But
so free suppressors for everybody is what we're getting to, right? That's what the future holds.
I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm going to guess it probably says unlikely. Yeah, I know. Bummer.
Yeah. Free tax stamps?
I think everybody forgets that, you know, all this attention and concentration, every election cycle, every presidential election cycle anyway, is always focused on who's going to be the president. And I think that most people forget from civics that the executive branch is only one of the three branches of government, and Congress has, in fact, exceedingly, way greater authority than the executive branch. At least it should. We've also seen that the executive branch has expanded its power through administrative agencies, and we can talk about that later if you want. But certainly, you know, ATF and the rulemaking that happened during the Biden administration, as far as, you know, the zero tolerance policy, which wasn't really rulemaking, but and then you get the I'm my sorry there? About that. My dog is here, and he's apparently decided to take the noisy toy.
Love it. Love it. Love it.
So, you know, the rulemaking that the Biden administration did through ATF, they didn't exactly make a rule through for the regulatory purposes as far as the zero tolerance policy as it relates to FFLs and certain violations. But the frames and receiver rule, the arm brace rule, they're all things that the president through the executive branch has directed these agencies to do. But Congress is really the one that holds the bag on a lot of this. And of course, when the law is set, you know, as far as what Congress wrote years ago, let's take the NFA as the example, because we were just talking about no tax stamps. Well, the law, in fact, does provide for a tax. So that's something that the agency just can't magically wave its hand and, you know, make disappear, unfortunately, for everybody who's kind of wishing such a thing. So, I think there are opportunities that this administration can take to improve things for gun owners, but a lot of it, unfortunately, at the end of the day, does require congressional action. And of course, you have Republicans, they did take the executive branch, they do control both chambers of Congress, but at the end of the day, like, you need 60 votes in the Senate, so show me how to get to 60 and we'll show you some things that maybe are possible.
Well, and something that I think people are not necessarily thinking about or paying attention to, but the some of the appointees that President-elect Trump has thrown out for his cabinet are some pretty good gun people, which is good for us, but that's taking them out of those houses. And we're not sure who's going to necessarily get appointed to fill those seats. So we're in a little bit of flux now, too, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, right now there's nobody that he's named as far as his interest for ATF director. To my knowledge, you know, the AG is the one that I think everybody's been paying most attention to, and that was Pam Bondi from down in Florida the other week. Yeah. So,
yeah, and she's not exactly the biggest gun rights supporter that he could have named.
You know, this was a conversation I had or was part of the other day, and I'm not going to sit here and say that she's, you know, 100% pro Second Amendment, and I don't think she's as anti either. You got to remember, the attorney generals do have a duty to defend the laws of mm-hmm. either the state that they're from, or in the case of the federal, you know, the federal laws. So if you look at some of the arguments, at least what was represented to me was, if you look at some of the arguments that were being made in some of these things where one would point to and be like, oh, that's anti-gun, you know, they were following what the law of the state was and just making the point that, well, under the laws of our state, you know, X, Y, Z. So there's a difference between having a duty to defend something and personally agreeing with it. Of course, you know, that also translates into the federal side of things here. But the, you know, the last point of that being that, you know, ATF falls under DOJ. So at the end of the day, you know, whoever the ATF director is doesn't necessarily matter if you have an attorney general who's going the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's a great point. I at one point in my life, I was the communications director for the Nebraska Attorney General. And there were a few times we had to, you know, defend a few laws that certainly the boss didn't agree with, but, you know, that's the duty. So I think that's a really solid point people need to take away.
Well, and politicians are always talking about compromise, right? You know, and that's, unfortunately, compromise is how we end up with so many rights being eroded away. But to go on a little bit of a historic aspect of things, you know, there compromise is how we ended up with the National Firearms Act of 1934. And the compromise in that is suppressors are NFA items because handguns are not NFA items, which is initially where we were going to end up back in 1934. And I mean, can you imagine what the political landscape would look like if you had to have a $200 tax stamp for every handgun? But what I'm getting at with that is that, you know, we're more than 90 years down the road since the NFA was introduced. And if we're talking about compromise, you know, with the current political landscape that we're coming into, Adam, what do you think is the likelihood that we could end up with some compromise that might remove suppressors from the NFA?
Show me how you get to 60 in the Senate. I don't see it happening.
I can't count that high.
Yeah, I don't see it happening. And that was the same thing I said years ago when the HPA was, you know, being touted as almost by certain people and companies as, oh, this is a done deal, particularly because Don Jr. is, you know, out here talking about it. Well, that's great. Don Jr. at the time was not part of the federal government. And on top of that, even if he were, you still need Congress, which is more than just a single individual. So I don't think that that's likely at all. I mean, hell, they couldn't even get concealed carry reciprocity passed, which is something that affects, you know, if we're talking a numbers game, far more people than, you know, whether silencers are, you know, part of the NFA or not. And then I think the other thing that people need to just keep in the back of their mind is the danger of amending laws, because it's a two-way street. Yeah, you open it up and maybe you get something you want, but what gets added potentially? Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know. I'm not omnipotent. I don't know what the future holds in that regard. But those are all things that are just very realistically things that could happen. But I think there are opportunities for congressional action on certain things. You know, like one of the easy ones would be the federal firearms relief determinations that ATF used to do up until 92. And then in the appropriations bill every year since then, there's been a provision that has said ATF cannot use any of the funding it receives to conduct those determinations. That would be a real easy one to strip out of the appropriations bill, because that goes through in an omnibus fashion where there's, you know, so many pages of stuff that nobody knows really what's in it, which is why we have the debt issue to a degree that we have. So it would just be, you know, one real low-hanging piece of fruit there.
So, Adam, can you explain what that determination, the funds and that action is?
Yeah, so federal law has a mechanism in it that still exists today because the law was never amended to remove it. And that says that the attorney general can grant federal firearms relief to individuals who are prohibited persons. So these would be individuals who are prohibited at the federal level, not state. And even if they were, if it was dual, you know, and they had applied, it would only help them federally, but at the state, you know, they'd still be prohibited. The caveat to that was that they had to be found to not be a danger to the public interest. The exact language is escaping me, but something along those lines. And so you had from 68 to 92, I think there were close to like 7,700 people granted federal firearms relief determinations. And if you look at some of the underlying offenses, some of these people were convicted of some violent crimes too. Not just, hey, I opened this bottle of ketchup in New Jersey and stuck it back on the shelf and now that's a felony, but like aggravated assault, things like that, where there was an element of you know, violence and arguably danger. And based on what the Supreme Court has said, you know, if we're looking at it from a court perspective, would that person ever, you know, have a chance in a courtroom of getting as applied relief? Probably not. But anyway, all that to say, ATF used to conduct these determinations and would grant them to people after they went through and figured out like, okay, well, we don't think you're, you know, granting relief to you is against the public interest here. Congress defunded that program, and what Congress said, there's a report anyway that alleges that a lot of these people who were granted relief ended up committing crimes again in the future. I've never looked into it that far, but this would be something that that Congress could absolutely give money back to ATF to do, and ATF could start to conduct things, and really it could use the analysis spelled out in Bruin for how to, or not Bruin, sorry, Rahimi, to kind of figure out, okay, like, you know, these people, there's been a judicial finding of dangerousness, so we're going to say that, like, it's probably constitutional to keep them restricted. But, you know, the guy who was stole $200 when he was in college because he was drunk and has lived for 30 years without committing a crime and now wants a firearm to protect his family, like, okay, well, that's somebody that, you know, we think. It's hard to say where that line is and articulate and argue it. You know, I don't have a great answer on that one because, you know, there's a whole range of things. Just because, you know, what if you got into a fight when you were in your 20s and really beat the hell out of somebody, but, you know, it was a one-off thing that has never been repeated, but, you know, it's a violent crime. Like, there's a lot of things, and I think that's probably one of the reasons that it was originally defunded anyway. So, but that's what the program was.
Before we get too far away from it, you mentioned something that was either incredibly specific or exceptionally random. But is it really a felony in New Jersey to take ketchup off the shelf, open it, and place it back?
I believe it is. So there was a opinion, and I can't remember if it was the majority opinion or if it was a dissent that Judge Bibas out of the Third Circuit wrote in one of these Second Amendment as applied challenges. And the exact case, I can't remember either. It was either Range or I think like Holloway or Flagitar. It might have been Flagitar. These were all as applied challenges, challenging the federal prohibition. And the underlying offense for Holloway was convicted of DUI in Pennsylvania at the highest rate of alcohol. Flagitar made a false statement on her federal tax return and was federally prohibited. And then Range applied for food stamps and fraudulently did so. He made a little over the threshold to be eligible for them. So in one of those opinions, and I think it was Flagitar, Bibas went through some of the crimes that would be federally prohibiting based on it being a state level crime that would trigger the 922 G1 prohibition. And I think that was one of them, was that essentially, like, if you open a bottle of ketchup in New Jersey and stick it back on the shelf, you've now committed a crime that's federally prohibiting. And I think it is. I think it may have been a felony.
Well, that is, Logan, hilarious. Using a bottle of ketchup as marinara sauce in New Jersey is also a felony.
Well, that should be a felony everywhere, let's be honest.
So that's something that maybe we could get 60 votes on and pass, you know, using ketchup let's just hope people don't do
table
that.
That one for now.
Yeah, table that one.
Get the pasta lobby involved. Big pasta coming in.
Big pasta. You're like, oh no, here comes Chef Boyardee. Oh my goodness. So in terms of, let's talk executive orders here for a second, because that has been one way that, you know, Biden has kind of sidestepped issues with Congress. What do you think we might see out of President Trump with some executive orders, either that may help us or may hurt us?
I'm not sure you'll see anything particularly out of the gates that will necessarily hurt as far as help. I don't have the slightest idea what he'd be inclined to do or not. I think the other thing that people forget is, if you look at this election cycle, guns were not really a topic of conversation. I think there was one debate question about it. You know, the gun community certainly is interested in it, and because it's somewhat of an echo chamber, like most echo chambers, that's all people here care about, and there a lot of them are single issue voters. But you look at broadly what was being talked about this election cycle, it was the economy, it was foreign policy, it was you know, other things like that, and not guns. So the question I think that kind of also is out there is, where does this sit on the administration's priority list? Yeah. Is it even a priority for the administration to deal with, or is it just going to be something that, like, okay, there's an opportunity and we'll get to it, and maybe there's somebody in the right place that does care about it that'll push it along? But I don't know. I think they'd be more inclined to look at economic issues and foreign, you know, policy issues and things like that first, especially in the first 100 days, rather than gun stuff. Not to you know, be a Debbie Downer about it, but I think that's just the realistic thing. You can't do everything at once. And yeah. I think, you know, the things that affect, you know, right now, people are pissed off about their wallets hurting and prices being, you know, up there, and the world going to hell in a handbasket in some ways, you know, in foreign countries. So that would be my guess. But I guess we'll find out as things progress.
So we may just get lucky and just kind of fly under the radar, like nothing good. You're not going to get anything good out of it, but we're not really going to get anything bad out of it either. And for sake of argument, I guess the status quo is better than things swinging in the wrong direction.
Guns definitely were not an issue. You know, we look at models going back for the last 4 or 5 election cycles at Gun Broker, and you know, we always see what we call the election lift. We always see an uptick in sales leading up to elections, certainly some years more so than others. And this year,
this year,
absolutely nothing. No, and again, it comes back to, you know, the famous line: "It's the economy, stupid." Mm-hmm. And you know, the politicians are going to look at it kind of the same way that we do. It's like, all right, what's our priority? Well, our priority is making sure our economic affairs are okay. Then we can get to the, you know, in our case, the fun stuff. We, you know, once we figure out how we pay the mortgage and buy gas and keep food on the table, yeah, then we can go, you know, shop for some fun stuff. And I think the administration is going to look at it the same way. How do we get, you know, the border safe and secure? How do we get the economy straightened out? Then after that, we can start looking at some other issues. So I think that's a pretty spot on analysis there, Adam.
No, and I you know, you also look at the industry and the part that's doing. I think, unfortunately, you're going to see a lot of industry members not survive the next 4 years just based on economics and lack of purchasing. But I think the one area of the industry that'll, if things continue the way they currently are, that will potentially grow, but at the very least, you know, survive and probably thrive, would be the silencer part of it. With the wait times as low as they are now, I think more now so than ever are buying silencers, because they realize that there is going to be a wait. It's just a question of how long is that wait. I've spoken to a couple of our corporate partners and other just friends in the industry that work in that specific segment, and they've all said that sales are extremely high, and they're having trouble, you know, fulfilling orders right now. They're so backordered on stuff. So it's going to be a little bit of, I think, a rough road for the firearms industry just from an economic standpoint. And you always have that when there's no threat. It's a messed up inverse, you know, relationship, where when there's a potential threat against your rights, which long term is by far the worst thing in the world, people, sales are up and people are buying and life is generally good for industry. And then when there's no perceived threat, because I don't want to say it's never removed, but there's no perceived threat, at least federally, you know, now people get complacent and don't do anything. You also have to remember, we always have two bodies of law. So on that point, simply just being that, well, there's a lot of blue states out there that are going to continue to pass anti-gun legislation and continue to march down that road of, we have another dumb idea that we're going to put into law. See California.
Yeah. Well, you know, so you had touched on suppressor wait times coming down, and that's, let's look at that a little bit. And because this kind of shows us, you know, because for the longest time, people for years have been saying that, you know, ATF has got to be purposely dragging their feet on these approval times. And now, especially with e-forms, although, you know, when e-forms first started and I put in a couple on eForms. It still took the better part of a year with the eForms. But now, you know, people are seeing stuff within days or within weeks. And it's kind of getting some people to say, see, they could have been doing this a lot faster the whole time. And so what is your take on that?
Well, yes and no. You got to remember the government's not dealing with exactly top of the line IT stuff. Like a lot of it's, this is the stuff that people don't see and they don't know because they haven't been involved in anything. So it's just, you know, if money were no object, sure. Could the government in theory do this a lot faster? Yeah. Part of the problem is that FBI is the one responsible for actually running those fingerprints. They do run them. And from, again, if we talk about priorities, well, what are they prioritizing? Criminal stuff, not people buying silencers and SBRs and stuff like that. So from a workflow perspective, they're not at the top of the pile. You know, there was a staffing issue. You have a massive influx of applications, regardless of whether they're digital or otherwise. It still takes people to process them. And I know it makes it sound like I'm just making excuses for the government, but it like there are some realities about things. You know, to give you an example that's in the same vein. When I was at my former employer, we had sued the city of Philadelphia during COVID for the wait times on processing license to carry firearms, so carry permits. And at the end of the day, you can only make them go so fast because there's only so many people in that office that can do something and can only work so many hours a day, and versus this massive influx of people coming to get permits. So it's great that maybe legally you're correct, but the reality sets in as far as dollars and personnel that it just, it can only go so fast. Now, could the government potentially do some things differently when it comes to NFA transactions? Yeah, I think so. If you look at what the law says you have to provide your photographs and fingerprints. It doesn't say that they have to run your fingerprints or that they have to do anything with them, just simply that they need to be provided. So in theory, if the technology were there and they were interested in working on it, could they potentially do a point of sale like right there where all that stuff is submitted, they run you through NICS comes back and you're good to go? Potentially, at least as far as individuals are concerned. Trust might be a little more complicated because they got to look at the document and things like that, unless it's, you know, one that was previously submitted and already approved. So there are things that they could potentially do to make that wait time in theory shorter. And that's at a very high level without having looked at really in depth at the nuts and bolts of, okay, well, like, how do things actually function on your side? Is this feasible? What needs to be implemented? What's the cost to do so? Things like that. So I think for right now, the fact that wait times have gone from 16 months to a significantly shorter period of time, like, yeah. Does it suck? Sure. Absolutely. Is it, you know, a problem? Yes, but it's much better than it was. And I think that's just the reality of what we live in currently. So unless the NFA is getting repealed or found to be unconstitutional, which I wouldn't hold my breath on either of those, that's where we are.
Well, and most of those problems really weren't addressed, you know, in this sudden cut and wait times. It was really simple things like batch processing. So, you know, if you send in 3 or 4 stamp applications, they're not treated individually and in line. It's like, oh, we just cleared this guy, so we can just rubber stamp these next 2 or 3. That made a massive difference. You know, also the whole, if there is a, as I understand it before, if they were processing an application and there was an issue, something they needed more information on, clarification or a correction, that just stopped the process. Now it's like, okay, we set that aside. We go to the next one in line and come back to that one. So even just kind of 2 simple little process things is what has led to this big improvement already. But there's so much more, as I'm hearing it, you know, out there just from a technology standpoint, for the process standpoint, that could speed things up, you know, even more. But yes, again, as a former government guy, you weren't they're not exactly dealing with the latest in tech. I mean, you know, unless you're a 3-letter agency, of course.
And they're also not the smartest of employees either. And I can get away with saying that because I was a federal employee at one point in time. So,
you know, it all depends on who you work with, obviously, like everything, you know, everything. But I think the other thing is, you know, there needs to also be a lot of recognition for the industry. You know, I'll use Silencer Shop as the example. Like Silencer Shop was the one that really worked with ATF to implement a lot of these things, at least initially. And so, you know, everybody likes to rag on ATF, and I get it, and you know, rightfully in a lot of ways it's deserved, but also the fact that industry does have the ability in some instances to work with a regulatory agency to improve a process, you know, should the process exist, that's an entirely different thing. But if we're stuck with the process, you would hope that we can work to make it as efficient as possible, so that way it's not as much of a roadblock to the, you know, being able to acquire those arms and utilize them.
And wouldn't it be great if we had a department that was dedicated to nothing but improving government efficiency, and they focused on this one?
That's weird. I feel like I've heard something about this on some platform that was formerly a bird, but now looks like an X or something. I don't know. Yeah, some smart guy.
They should put a dog like in charge as the mascot of it. I think, yeah, it might go somewhere, Alan. You might be onto something there.
Hey everyone, Logan Medish of High Caliber History and the host of the No Low Ballers podcast here. If you're passionate about firearms, accessories, and everything in between, there's one place you need to check out: GunBroker.com. Whether you're looking to buy, sell, or just browse, GunBroker is the world's largest online marketplace for firearms, ammunition, and all the gear that you need. It's a trusted platform that connects buyers and sellers across the U.S., offering everything from rare and collectible firearms to the latest models. Plus, with a wide range of accessories, parts, and ammo, GunBroker.com is a one-stop shop for gun enthusiasts of all kinds. So whether you're an experienced gun owner or you're just getting started, make sure to visit GunBroker.com to find exactly what you're looking for. And don't forget, you can also tune in to our No Low Ballers podcast to hear more about the history behind your favorite firearms, sponsored by GunBroker.com.
So we've talked a few times. We've mentioned, you know, the magical number of 60. Is there anything that would be beneficial to our community that you think we actually could reach 60 votes on?
I think the only one that's off the top of my head that I think you potentially have any chance of is concealed carry reciprocity, and that would be coming from your swinging a couple of Democrats in blue states, or I can't remember if Manchin's seat flipped to a Republican or not, but you know, he was a Democrat coming out of West Virginia, and you know, Democrat in name only on a lot of things. So mm-hmm. I think you would have to find some senators from states like that where, yeah, it's they're a Democrat, but their state, like, this is important to their constituency. And you know, they're looking at being reelected, not necessarily towing the party line for a better committee assignment or something like that. So that, or they throw the filibuster out the window, but they've already said they're not going to do that.
Right. Because, I mean, realistically, we're looking at a two-year window, because historically the midterms always go opposite of the party in the White House. That's just, I think, what, one time in our history that hasn't happened. But for the most part, that's just a given.
You would need a killer first 2 years for that to not be the case. But yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like we haven't made history with this election, because being the history nerd that I am, I tell anyone who will listen, guys, we haven't had a non-consecutive term president since 1892. And I just think that's so damn cool. If for no other reason than it's a neat bit of trivia. So
yeah, no, that is, it definitely is neat, I guess, because I'm thinking any other word is failing to come to mind. So I'll just go with neat.
Well, and let's be honest, with this particular president, the historical norms tend to go a little bit out the window as well. So,
yeah,
you know, making any form of prediction, when we were trying to figure out what to put in our plan for a budget or a election lift, like, yeah, we have no idea what's going to happen, because, you know, everything that we think should happen doesn't happen with this particular candidate. And you know, that's not even counting the kind of morass that the other side put forward. But
yeah,
you know, if we can, you know, kind of shift gears a little bit, because I know a lot of people, myself included, that a couple of times in the past few elections, we've not necessarily voted for the candidate, but we voted for the Supreme Court and the federal court levels, knowing that, you know, if we had the right candidate in place, even though we might not necessarily be a big fan or supporter of them, that's really how our industry and our passion is going to win back some of our rights, really, is through the court. Because like you said, we need 60 in any legislative action, and that's a really tough hill to climb these days, where the courts, you know, if the judges and justices we see there are of our mindset, that that should make, I would think, some things a little bit easier. So, you know, what's that future look like for you? I mean, at the end of the day, I think the question is Sotomayor going to retire or not?
I don't think you need to worry about Sotomayor. I think you need to worry more about Thomas and Alito. They're getting up there. So, yeah, that's kind of how I pitched this election cycle to everybody that, you know, would listen. I said I wouldn't necessarily bet on pro-gun action coming out of the presidency or the Congress, even if they both go red. But what I would bet you on is that you get four more years of Democratic judicial nominees, you have a massive problem. Even everybody looks at the Supreme Court, and certainly the Supreme Court's a very important one. Let's not downplay that. But here's the reality. Biden, I think, is on track to appoint more judges than Trump did in his first term. So you get four more years of that. And what happens if we ignore the Supreme Court for a moment? Well, it means you have roughly 800 new judges on the federal bench that are going to likely not think that the Second Amendment deserves the protections it's been given, you know, constitutionally, that it already has, and that what the Supreme Court has said, like, no, do it this way. And the reason I say that is because you look post Heller, you get Heller in 2008, you get McDonald in 2010, and what do you get until Bruin? You get 12 years of courts creating a two-step test and interest balancing away the Second Amendment, particularly in, you know, all the circuits, but the Ninth Circuit in particular. There were 50 Second Amendment lawsuits post-Heller in the Ninth Circuit, and not one of them survived the en banc court if a panel found that, you know, it was an unconstitutional law. So why does that matter? Well, it matters because the Supreme Court doesn't have to take these types of cases. They're on a petition of certiorari to the Supreme Court, which is basically asking the court, please hear our case. And the court's under no obligation to hear any of these challenges. So what will happen potentially, or could have happened, or may still happen anyway, is that those petitions get written. There's some briefing done on it. And the court takes a vote and says, yeah, we're not going to hear this. And we saw that. How many cert petitions on Second Amendment issues have gone to the Supreme Court versus what was granted? Very, you know, like hundreds versus a handful. Yeah, so
historically, they're hesitant to take 2A cases.
Well, and
been a little different lately, but historically, the court's always been a little hesitant to go down that road.
I mean, let's be honest. If you ignore Miller out of the 30s, which wasn't a great case anyway, you get Heller in 2008. You have Staples, and you have some other cases that kind of touch on the Second Amendment, but Heller was the first seminal case on Second Amendment. So Second Amendment jurisprudence, we can, you know, arguably say, is really in its infancy as compared to First Amendment, which has over 100 years of development going on it. And of course, the Second Amendment borrows heavily from First Amendment jurisprudence, things like that. So the reason it matters, you know, going back to the judges for a moment, the reason it matters is because if you have a district court judge who says, yeah, you know what, Supreme Court said the test should be done this way, but I think I can see a way to kind of say I'm doing it, but not really do it, and find a result that, you know, against a challenge that upholds the law as constitutional, and then it goes to a circuit court and the circuit court does the same thing or just upholds it and affirms the decision, whether it's en banc or not. Then you have other circuits looking to that circuit, and the next thing you know, here becomes the law of all the circuits because they're all kind of just adopting what each one does. Until the Supreme Court steps in and clears things up, you're kind of screwed. So if you have judges that are going to make the correct constitutional interpretation by being faithful to not only what the text of the Constitution is, but what the Supreme Court has said, it creates a very different landscape in theory.
Granted, my law degree came out of a box of Fruit Loops, but
that's a good degree. Yeah. Is it? Do you have that one? Can I get a copy of that one?
Is that actually signed by Toucan Sam?
Mine came from the Mark Zuckerberg School of Law.
But he spelled it with a K, so I don't know if it's binding. But the way I've always described why the lower courts are so more important, it's like replay in sports. It's a lot harder to overturn the initial call on the field than it is to get it to either stand or confirm. And it's kind of that way in the courts. If you're on the appeal side of a lower court's decision, that's a little bit bigger hurdle, a bigger road to climb. Whereas if you've got two or three lower courts that, you know, the other side is trying to appeal, that's got to be a little bit easier from your side to defend.
It all depends. I mean, you get some judges that are in fact activist judges because there's no other way to phrase it.
And, yeah.
And then you get some, and then you get some appellate courts that go, you just screwed this up and did this entirely wrong. Like we're reversing this. It's a mixed bag. Unfortunately, some of it you go in having this idea that like, we're probably not going to prevail. We think we should. And, you know, we need to, we're also, at least at SAF, we're very careful about the cases we file because we don't want to create bad precedent and bad case law, because that's really difficult, as you were just kind of getting at, to make go away, particularly when a circuit court says like, yeah, you know what, that judge's opinion, we're going to affirm that. And here's all the things. And then it becomes the law of the circuit, and away we go. So we are very careful as to the types of lawsuits we get. And so going back to our first topic of conversation for a moment, the NFA, you know, all these people are like, well, why aren't you suing to repeal the NFA? Well, dude, show me one circuit court that has said that so-called assault weapons are protected arms under the Second Amendment, the most commonly possessed semi-automatic firearm in the country. Show me one court that said that these are protected arms, because they're, as far as circuit courts, because you're not. So how are we going from these are not protected arms from the circuit court level to all the stuff in the NFA clearly unconstitutional? Like, you're just it's not happening that way. And so we're very, the point of that being like, we're very careful about what we pick to bring, because yes, from an ideological standpoint, do I think the NFA is unconstitutional garbage? 100%. Would I like there to be machine guns, you know, readily available at your local drugstore? Sure. But realistically, where we are now and ever potentially getting there, worlds apart.
Yeah, we lost our rights over 100 years. It's probably going to take 100 to get most of them back.
Yeah. And yes. So I think, you know, we're looking at the Supreme Court, and this is a conversation I've had with a number of people over the last year or so. But you look logically at how the Supreme Court has accepted Second Amendment cases. If we say Heller was the start, and we just ignore the other handful of touch points before, you had individual right, untethered to militia service, handguns are protected arms. You get McDonald, which incorporates the Second Amendment against the states. You get Catano, which is a per curiam opinion, but basically, you know, just says like, hey, these things, they didn't exist at the founding, but they're still arms and they're still covered. You get Bruin, which talks about carry, even though Heller did that. And Heller also spelled out the test for Second Amendment challenges, just to be clear. So what did Bruin do? Bruin expanded on the carry issue, and it reaffirmed like, hey, what we told you in 2008 as far as the test is the test, so start doing the test. And then you get Rahimi, because the Fifth Circuit forced the Supreme Court's hand on that. So, you know, Rahimi deals, for those that don't know, dealt with an individual who's under a domestic violence restraining order, and he challenged the constitutionality of him being deprived of his Second Amendment rights. But you look logically, you get an individual right, you get it incorporated against the states, you get arms that were not in existence at the time of the founding are in theory protected, and you get carry expanded on more heavily. So logically, what's next for the Supreme Court to tackle? Well, they could expand on sensitive places, what are and aren't sensitive places, because they didn't do a hot job of that the first go round, and they knowingly didn't do that. They could deal with carry issue delays as far as permits, excessive fees, things like that. Certainly the types of arms that are protected under the Second Amendment, like assault weapons and magazine capacity, would be a next logical choice for them to take. And then potentially the 18 to 20 issue. As well, like, there's a lot of those cases that we're involved in that are percolating through the courts as far as whether it's 18 to 20 purchase of a long gun, carrying firearms, or, you know, we have two challenges to the federal ban on being able to purchase handguns from FFLs. So I think logically there's certainly places for the Supreme Court to go next based on how they've taken cases. It's just a question of, are they going to, and if so, which one? Hopefully they'll take our assault weapons ban challenge, Snope, that comes out of Maryland. That's up on a cert petition. And for those that don't know, today is December 6th. That goes to conference for the first time on the 13th. So in a week, that'll be there. And I don't think we'll hear anything the first go around, but hopefully they grant cert and we can finally get this issue taken care of.
Now, if and when we end up with a vacancy or multiple vacancies on the Supreme Court over the course of the next 4 years, is there anyone that either you personally or you guys at SAF, you know, would be thinking would be good choices to try to get confirmed?
I mean, there are judges that are definitely Second Amendment friendly, but I think there's a lot more, again, much like Congress or the administrative priorities, you know, for the term that goes into it, other than just, well, where are they on guns? I think there's a whole host of other issues that are being vetted, you know, in addition to their temperament and things like that. But yeah, there's probably a handful. The two that I would kind of throw out there would probably be Judge Van Dyke out of the Ninth Circuit. He's been written some pretty scathing opinions. And, you know, Bibas being another one that I think he's just a good jurist out of the Third Circuit. But, you know, that's above my pay grade. And there are people far smarter than I that are looking at those judges and for the potential openings.
And I think Justice Alan Gottlieb has such a nice ring to it.
I don't know. The eighth grader in me really wants to be able to say Associate Justice Bibas, because that just...
I've been sitting on so many Bibas comments that someone had to go there.
You can always trust me for a good eighth grade joke, Alan. So, Adam, we mentioned that we met with you guys back in January of this year at the beginning of your 50th anniversary. And now here we are in December of this year talking about the end of your 50th anniversary. And so can you tell us what has that been like for you guys over the course of this year? And how have you guys been celebrating your 50 years?
Yeah, so it's certainly been a very exciting thing to be a part of. You know, especially coming in and then kind of reminding Alan, like, hey, you've been at this for 50 years, man. You've accomplished quite a bit in 50 years. You know, you built a hell of an organization that's accomplished a number of things throughout the years. But most notably, I think, would be McDonald versus City of Chicago. You know, the case that allows us to sue all the states and municipalities for Second Amendment violations. That's the crown jewel of SAF right now, I think. Not to say that there's... you know, bodies of other work that would certainly be up there as far as accomplishments. But that, you know, I think touting a Supreme Court win is probably the best you could do. And that was the whole point of the organization when it was founded anyway, was to get a case to the Supreme Court. So it's been a lot of fun. We've, you know, done some things. We created a video series where we interviewed a bunch of people who have been involved with SAF for a number of years, you know, as outsiders, and some people that, you know, either work here or work closely with us, but, you know, to kind of give some perspective of what the organization had done over the 50 years and hear from people who had been around for the earlier years, because I only walked in the door in November 2022. So one of the things I found interesting in kind of doing all this was that I learned a lot more about the organization than I had ever known, the amount of work that it's done over the years as far as involvement with the scholarly community and the education and publishing side of things were unknown to me, even though I had been fairly involved in not only the nonprofit area for, you know, 3 years prior to coming here, but the firearms industry. So we've done things like that. You know, we've made some cool swag that we've given out to people, but really it was just kind of a celebration and reminding people that not only do we exist, but we've been here for some time and have done a lot of work on, you know, your behalf during that time period. So it all kind of went into the whole raise the profile of the organization.
Well, you know, this summer at your gun rights policy conference, which, again, if you're interested at all in helping protect and fight the fight, you got to go to this. It's you know, open to folks. It's not an industry event. It's a fantastic place to network and learn about what's going on. I cannot recommend it enough. But, you know, this summer I thought you guys did a really, really great job in recognizing Alan's work with your new Golden Bow Tie Award. That, you know, if anybody knows Alan Gottlieb, you know that bow tie. You know. Just watching his face and reaction while that first award was given out to honor Tom Taylor of SIG, but really to honor Alan, that was a great moment.
Yeah, he had no idea we were doing that either, which was the best part about it. So that was why he had that look. That was entirely a surprise. But the Gun Rights Policy Conference, this was the first year where it was entirely on our shoulders to plan. And you saw that through, you know, again, in changing the signage and kind of the presentation of the event and also the agenda itself. I rolled the dice pretty hard this year on going away from a formula that the organization was comfortable with and had been doing for so many years to let's try something new and see how it goes. And people loved it. So we're going to continue to go down that. This coming year, we will not be in California. For all of you that had issues with that, you know, good news, we won't be in California. We'll be in a state that is more friendly to the rights. But I did think it was important to go to the places that, you know, are not as friendly to our rights to show we're not afraid. For that matter, as I said at the event, and I think now it's, there's one more, but I think we have like 15 to 17 cases that are active in California. So it goes right with the theme that we're bringing the fight to the people who want to strip away your rights versus just kind of looking for easy pickings in friendly areas. So anyway, yeah, Gun Rights Policy Conference was cool. We did try to honor Alan and kind of acknowledge the 50th anniversary there as well. You know, I don't know how you do a 50th anniversary for an organization. I'm figuring it out as I go, help with other people. So the good news is if I ever find myself in a position to celebrate another anniversary, I'll have some idea of how it works.
Well, I'll tell you, as we were, you know, during the touristy things kind of before and after, you know, the Uber drivers are always, you know, a little chatty with you and they ask what you're in town for. And, you know, we tell them what we were there for. And I didn't have one that didn't give some response of, oh, great, please get some of these. You know, they were granted San Diego's a Navy town and most of these guys had the right haircuts. But every one of them was like, yeah, if that's what they're here for and they're trying to help us out, please tell them that, you know, we back them. You know, they fight the fight for us, please.
We were at the bar after it was over, I was having lunch, and there was a guy sitting there that struck up a conversation. Like, you know, what's this gun thing I keep seeing about? Turns out he works for American Outdoor Brands. So like, hang on, I got some t-shirts. I'll be right back. And I ran into him at like NASGW since then. So it was just funny how small of a world it was. He was in town to like go to Legoland or something with his family. So,
oh, that's funny. Well, Adam, we appreciate you being here and spending some time to give us some insight into what we may or may not be expecting in the upcoming administration. I know that I personally have learned a lot and am learning to temper my expectations. But I think that's a good thing for people to understand that there's a lot more that goes into it than just like a lot of us being single issue voters. You know, there's a lot more going on behind the scenes
that people don't necessarily think about. It's definitely given me a lot to think about as I consider the request I've had to take on the directorship of ATF. So I've got a lot more to think about now. I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. And I guess I would end this by saying I'm the eternal pessimist. So take everything I say with a grain of salt. I do have a degree in political science, but I'm not really following or involved in government. And also, I just from a personal perspective, I usually temper my expectations significantly. So more often than not, I'm surprised when things happen, and like that's cool. But when those things don't happen, I'm like, all right, well, I didn't expect it to anyway. So I think. Right. I tried to provide a realistic outlook on things. And again, you know, it's just one guy's opinion. So take it for what it's worth. Might not be worth anything. And if so, I'm sorry you listened to the podcast with me rambling on for however long we've been going.
Oh, goodness. Well, Adam, really, we do appreciate you spending some time with us. You're always a great guest. We're glad to have had you back. And here's to another 50 years for you guys.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you having me and look forward to the next time.
Alrighty, everyone, that's going to do it for us today on this episode of the No Lowballers podcast. We appreciate you being here, each and every one of you tuning in and listening to our ramblings and musings and all sorts of odd things that pop into our heads, because without you, there is no us, and we like being us. So please share this episode with people that you think might enjoy it. I know if you are watching or listening to this, that you know other people who are speculating on what the next 4 years are going to look like. So please share this with them. I think they would definitely learn some things from it. And if you guys have comments or questions, you know, throw them into the comment section. We do read and respond to all that stuff. So sound off and let us know what you think the next 4 years are going to look like. So once again, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode of the No Lowballers podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.